Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode number 126. It's going to go up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox, YouTube, my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com in the podcast section, and it'll be on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog and the podcast section. I want to remind you that I wrote two books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. Check them out on Amazon. You can also get them on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. And on the website, you can buy them only for cryptocurrency. So check them out. Today, I am welcoming Michael Heiss. Michael is the founder of the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus. Michael's going to talk about what the Mises Caucus does, and he's going to talk about some successes that they've had recently in bringing back the pure libertarian and the Fed anti-war message to the Libertarian Party. So, without any further delay, this is a recording I did with Michael Heiss. Enjoy. I'm here with Michael Heiss. How are you doing, Michael?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Cool. You are the founder of the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus. Is that correct?
I am.
Tell everybody, what is the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus?
The Mises Caucus, what originally was like the vision that I had that caused me to do this was I came out of the Ron Paul revolution, and anybody who experienced that knows how special that time was. Anybody who was really involved, they know how special that time was and how energizing and unifying it was. And as we've experienced over the years, that energy has kind of dissipated it and never really coalesced anywhere. So the Mises Caucus is essentially my attempt to try to reinvigorate the spirit of the Ron Paul movement within the Libertarian Party and have a home for all of the Austro-Libertarians, which I would say comprises of a lot of, or most of, Ron Paul's base. So, you know, the Ron Paul fans, the Mises Institute fans, Tom Woods fans, Mises fans, all of that kind of stuff.
You just hosted an event in New Orleans that sort of coincided with the first day of the Libertarian National Convention. What were you guys doing in New Orleans?
So basically, that event was called the Take Human Action Bash, and Take Human Action has been our tagline and kind of our rallying call, you know. And what that was that was the first day of the convention, which there's no official party business that required like delegate votes or anything on that day. So we figured it would be a good day to try to do an event, and we tried to work with the party to have it with them, but essentially they weren't interested. So what we did was we tried to have all of the best speakers that we could think of from the Austrian libertarian sphere, as well as the crypto sphere, because crypto is in my mind kind of the other half of what we're about, because it's a market determined decentralized peer-to-peer money that we can use ourselves without government. So we had plenty of great speakers there. We had Rob Viglione from Zencash. We had Tom Woods give just an amazing speech as a headliner. Ron Paul gave us a video. Jeff Dice, the president of the Mises Institute, stopped by and gave a speech. Walter Block gave a speech on like 15 minutes notice. Scott Horton was there. Several other cryptos like Publica, Smart Cash. I think I said Zencash already. It was just an amazing event. Bob Murphy was there. I mean, it was just star studded. It was incredible.
With the exception of the crypto people you mentioned, Tom Woods, Walter Block, Scott Horton, Bob Murphy, they've all been on my podcast. So my listeners are well aware. Scott Horton's been on my podcast 4 or 5 times. So, yeah, I think the people who are listening are, I hope at this point their ears are perking up so that they can understand exactly what was going on there.
Scott Horton provided for kind of a really cool side story to the whole thing, where you know, the night before the event, me and Tom and some of the Mises Caucus guys, we were hanging out in the room where the event was going to be, and I get a text from Scott Horton saying that he's about 2.5 hours away and that his transmission went down and that he doesn't know what he's going to do. So this is, we're talking 16 hours maybe before the event, something like that. And, our community is so strong in the Mises Caucus, that we were able to put the call out overnight, fundraise him enough money and send out an envoy to go get him, bring him there. And then we raised enough money to fix his car to get him back. And he actually was able to go home and get his buddy home on time. And so I thought that was just a really cool side story that just randomly happened during the whole thing to kind of show and express what kind of community that we have with the Mises Caucus. And this all happened within the span of 11 months that we built this up. This was an idea 11 months ago.
I thought libertarians, anarcho-capitalists, and voluntarists are supposed to be really greedy.
Well, that's the rap, but it's always people who want your stuff that say that, so.
Good answer. Good answer. So you guys didn't go down there to have a great time and listen to great speakers and then have Eric July and backwards bring the house down. You guys went to go to the LNC as well. What were you guys doing at the LNC?
Well, one of the purposes of the event was to kind of set the tone and set the energy on the first day of the convention, you know, to make a statement and say, hey, we're here, we're loud, we're not going anywhere, and we're a force to be reckoned with. Now, as far as the convention, we came out of the gates very strong, boldly saying, we're done with this leadership. You know, we don't feel that the leadership reflects libertarian values, doesn't market libertarian principles very well, and we would like a change. So that's pretty much how we came on the scene. And we grew very, very rapidly because, and no one believes this, but it was a total coincidence. So the chair of the party, Nick Sarwark, had made some, we'll say, extremely inflammatory comments about Tom Woods and Jeff Dice and the Mises Institute. And he said these things on Twitter. And I don't use Twitter. I've never used Twitter. I don't like Twitter. And I had been kicking around the idea of a Mises Caucus for a couple months, and you can like check that by searching hashtag Mises Caucus. And, I just happened to decide to make a Facebook group a few hours, I guess, before that outburst happened. And the result was I absorbed the entire fallout of those comments organically by happenstance. That's what started this whole thing. So it's just been a really crazy ride of, a path just seemingly open up before me as I zoom down these past 11 months.
Well, one thing I find interesting, and anyone who's listening to this and knows that I've never been one, and I've spoken against political action, but you had speakers there who I know for a fact that of the four you mentioned Walter Block, the four non-crypto speakers, Walter Block, Tom Woods, Bob Murphy, and Scott Horton. I know that they are all anarchists. They would consider themselves to be anarcho-capitalists, and they can back up that, you know, tell you why very clearly. I mean, there's, you know, people think about Scott Horton and they think of foreign policy, but no, get him talking about some economics and it will make your jaw drop. I think from what I know of being in your Facebook group, there are a lot of ANCAP voluntarists in there. Why do you think you're attracting people who would normally not consider joining a party, much less vote?
Well, I have a few answers for that, honestly. I mean, one, I'm a fan of the Lysander Spooner argument. You know, I think if you... We all understand self-defense on a one-to-one level. You know, if you throw a punch at me, it's over for you. You know, like if you commit violence against me, I can retaliate as I need to stop you. However, I don't think there's any stretch to macro that principle out to say the dictates of government. Why shouldn't I be able to defend myself from the dictates of democracy? You know, I mean, I'm at their whim, and it's kind of in my mind, an acceptance that a lot of libertarians resist making because it's kind of a blow to the ego. But the truth of the matter is that we are, in fact, by definition, slaves. We can think we're not. We can act like we're not. We can huff and puff and talk about all these different ways that the government is illegitimate and all of that. But the fact of the matter is you live in their wheelhouse. They set the arbitrary rules. They have the okay to commit violence, and you're probably not going to get broken out of jail if they take you. You know, so that is the objective situation. So we have to work with the tools that we're given. Now, I talked about the Ron Paul revolution, and we didn't really have these conversations back then. It was so new, and it was, you know, the Liberty Movement was launched through all that, and we all understood what we were fighting for, and we all had an energy about us. You know, there was this culture, it seemed like, of working, of being excited by what was going on and working alongside it, producing results and having fun, which turned into this like positive feedback loop that kept going until finally the campaign was like murdered down in the convention in Florida. But as far as why our voluntarists do it, I feel like we've given them an argument that they can't refute, because alongside the Lysander Spooner argument, there's the fact of the matter that the Libertarian Party exists. It's existed for over 40 years, well over 40 years. And eventually they're going to get debate access like that. That's going to happen. And it, believe it or not, and I'm not saying this as some, I mean, I supported Gary Johnson, but I'm not saying this as some giant fanboy of Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson came surprisingly close to getting debate access. I mean, and he did that with a divided party with, I think, like a $12 million campaign. And he almost got in. He came close enough to where they had to screw with him to keep him out. They manipulated polls with him as well. They locked out almost the entire 35 and under demographic from polls to not allow him to hit the 15%. But what people don't realize is that Gary Johnson has been waging a lawsuit against the debate commission ever since. And he scored a major victory. He scored a major victory in that the debate commission, a federal judge has ruled that the debate commission was acting in a bipartisan way and not a nonpartisan way. And as such, they're going to have to rewrite their rules. And this wasn't even appealed. Okay, so we have an easier path to debate access going forward, and now because of the 4 million some odd votes that he got the party, we also have much easier ballot access, which is traditionally one of the most energy and resource intensive hurdles to overcome as a candidate. So ultimately what that means and what kind of spurred me into action is the vision that I saw is, okay, debate access is a realistic possibility at some point in the foreseeable future. Who's it going to be that is libertarian, this philosophy that we all love, whether you're in the party or not, who is going to be the opening act? Who's going to be the first, the first impression to when we enter the world political stage, as far as everybody who is not already like us sees it, you know? So then I started thinking about, well, if something isn't done, that's going to be Bill Weld or Bob Barr or some moderate or some beltway, you know? And, that's not what inspired me. What inspired me is anti-Fed, anti-war, pro-humanity type messaging that lit up millions of young people with Ron Paul. And I want to make sure that what I feel is proper representation of the libertarian message is what gets out in that first impression.
So you mentioned Ron Paul. And I think you and I through Facebook have talked and said that in 2007 we were both inspired. And it's so easy to forget because it was 11 years ago, and a lot of the people who are listening to this right now were kids. They were not even early teens. Some of them were 7, 8, 9 years old at the time. And they don't realize exactly what that was like and how crazy it was. Talk about how that changed so much, even though Ron Paul couldn't get 5% in most states.
Well, and that's a point that I've made too, is that there's a lot of people, especially if like your involvement through the Libertarian Party and the Gary Johnson campaign, I feel like there's a lot of libertarians who are a part of this movement who have actually never experienced this movement when it was at its most healthy and cohesive and powerful, you know, because anybody who experienced that knows that the establishment was very, very afraid, and they had great reason to be. What do I think has happened between the Ron Paul movement and now? Is that the question?
Just tell your story of like what was happening back then when you heard the debates and you heard what Ron Paul was talking about. Because I'm trying to the message I'm trying to get out with this podcast, and that I'm sure that you agree with, is that having someone up there on the stage saying the things that we honestly believe does make a difference.
Yeah. Oh, it makes a big difference. And especially at that point in time, because, you know, 11 years might not seem like, but the internet is in a completely different state than it was 11 years ago. I mean, the 11 years ago it was big, but it wasn't anywhere near as big as it is now. And, that's where most people got their first contact with him, was the internet. So the internet's a really, really important venue. But as far as my experience, in 08, I was only like 18 or 19. And you know, my family didn't have, we had like a family computer in the living room and got that kind of late, you know, so I didn't even have that much. So I didn't know anybody. I just knew that I felt something deep inside from what he was saying, and I believed in it. And, you know, me and my best friend were kind of like the outcasts. So, you know, it was kind of just between us. It wasn't until the 2012 campaign where I really started to get involved and basically just took action myself and started bullhorning outside of the Federal Reserve in Philly and trying to organize a little End the Fed rallies. And then before I knew it, I got hooked up, you know, there was like 70 people there, and I found out that there was this whole underground, crew of anarchists essentially in Philly that was doing a lot of grassroots work for the campaign. And, they weren't partisans. You know, political activism wasn't the meat of what they normally did, but they also were inspired by Ron Paul, and it just spiraled into this, getting swept up into this underground world where it's like everybody you met was your new best friend. You know, like some things that did not happen. Let me tell you about some things that did not happen during the Ron Paul campaign. You did not hear things like, well, were you a Republican or were you a Democrat? Are you a minarchist or are you an anarchist? Are you, like, everybody was just freedom fighters. You know, we were all united under a goal, under a leader that we believed in, and who was espousing a message that we believed in. We didn't have the division. I feel like the division came in after the fact, when that energy never concretely coalesced into something else. And there was like the rise of these personalities and these outlets and all these things. And it was cool for a little while, and we were debating. And that's where, in my experience, at least, you know, the popularization of all the different hyphenated anarchisms came out. And, you know, we all earned our stripe fighting each other for a couple of years, but eventually the debates started turning into fights. And where there was positivity and optimism that we can actually take on the empire or change something, it started turning into cynicism and pessimism. And I feel like it just festered because there was nothing that ever came along and swept it back into something to form around.
Hmm. Now, I want to go back to the LNC from the previous weekend. You ran the Mises Caucus, sponsored or endorsed candidates against Nick Sarwak, and I can't pronounce the name of the gentleman who was the vice chair.
Arvin Vora.
Now, you guys ran endorsed candidates against them, is that correct?
Yes, we did.
So talk about what happened.
So, like I said, we came out with a bold statement at first saying, look, you know, we might be new around here, but because I didn't even join the party until 2016. And, you know, we might be new around here, but this is not libertarianism as we understand it. So we need new leadership. And of course, they laughed at us first, but then, you know, we got like 15,000 or 1500 members in our first like month, and nobody was laughing anymore. So, you know, Josh, at first what I tried to do was I was very fortunate in that a friend of mine was one of the founding members of a really amazing cryptocurrency called Nexus. And he invited me to their conference. And this was relatively early on in the history of the Mises Caucus. And, you know, a lot of the people that formed Nexus were big Ron Paul fans. So Judge Knapp was there. Ron Paul was there. Charles Hoskinson, who was like a anarchist Ron Paul fan, head of Cardano, which is like a top 10 market cap coin. He was there. who else? Dennis Kucinich was there. Jesse Ventura was there. The Nexus guys obviously were there. Like, there was all this good networking to be having, and I was invited to go. So at first I was trying to run a name. You know, I basically threw a Hail Mary at Judge Knapp, said, "Hey man, we need you to run for chair." And the crazy thing is it's not even that he said no, like, "I don't want to." He basically said, "No, I can't. Like, I actually can't because of my Fox News contract." So, you know, once I exhausted all those options, at the time I didn't know Josh, and I knew he had put his ring in, or his hat in the ring to run for chair. So I reached out to him and started getting to know him. And, you know, we just had conversations that bounced back and forth for hours and got to be good friends really fast. And, so he did to me what he was able to do to so many other people so often throughout the campaign, which is talk to them one on one and win them over. And, once it was locked in that, all right, I think this is going to be our guy, it was full steam ahead. Mm.
So, okay. So, and then you guys go to the convention. There had to be debates, for the chair and for the vice chair. So how did everything, I'm a baseball fan. What was the final score?
Well, the vote, I don't think the vote is a very good indicator of, I know this sounds ridiculous, but I don't think the final vote was a good indicator of the will of the delegates. And the reason I say that, and this is going to get completely lost to history because Josh didn't win, people don't realize what the numbers looked like going into the convention versus the vote that actually happened. And something happened to shake the confidence of a lot of delegates, I suspect. And, you know, I have nothing but love for Josh. He knows that. But I think he would agree with me that he underperformed in the debates. And essentially the story of the race here was that I love Josh's vision. I love his drive. You know, I love the fact, I mean, the Mises Caucus was able to help fundraise the majority of his funds to travel to 20 different state conventions. I don't think anything like that has ever happened before in the history of a Libertarian Party chair race. We're talking about a volunteer position. You know, and he went to 20 different state party conventions and chopped it up with the membership out there to see what the party really wants. And, so essentially the story was that people were down with his vision. People were down with his personality. He was able to win a lot of people over. The one big concern was, well, he's never served on the national committee. He doesn't have experience. So I think that was the main concern going in. And I don't think his debate performance, made too many people believe that wasn't a problem. You know what I mean? Like, I think some people were kind of confirmed in their fears, but there was a lot of things at play. I mean, they allowed an actual literal communist to be on that debate stage. And unless you were involved in the race, you wouldn't know that there was, or involved online with the race, you wouldn't know that there is a longstanding personal history between that communist and Josh. And the amount of bullshit that was thrown Josh's way. I'm talking about people dragging his family into it, people going after his character, saying he's an alcoholic, people literally doxed his exes and reached out to them to try to dig dirt up on him. You know what I mean? Like, it was totally nasty, and this guy was part of it. So, you know, part of the debate thing was he allowed the communists to get under his skin, which allowed Nick to look really clean. And, I think that was the story of it. But what people don't realize is that going into the convention, before that debate happened, we had directly polled the delegates, and we had our own delegates that were polling their respective state delegations. Josh only needed like a little over 100 votes going into the convention compared to over 300 that Nick needed. So the point that I'm making there is that while Josh may not have won, the desire for change was there. I think his debate performance just maybe convinced people that he needed some experience, which he's going to get now because we were able to get him on the national committee, just not as chair.
But he's is he at large?
He's at large, so he's a voting member of the board and one of the leaders in the party.
Well, what about vice chair?
Vice chair, our guy won. Alex. So the vice chair, Arvin Vara, was extremely unpopular because He was just constantly making extremely inflammatory comments that, you know, there is a distinction between you know, you have to understand when you're entering the realm of politics. It's one thing for an activist to say, you know, some random activist or blogger or podcaster to say, you know, the troops are welfare whores. It's a completely different thing when the leader of the Libertarian Party says it. I mean, I've literally experienced in my going out petitioning for candidates, people who were like, I'm from the military and I will not sign that petition to get your candidate on because the Libertarian Party is anti-military. Which I would say we're anti-empire. I don't think we're anti-military like service member individuals. You know? So it's just stuff like that. You know, teachers are welfare whores, all troops are murderers and stuff like this where you kind of have to have that separation between being an activist and being the leader of a political party.
So Alex Merced won, and tell us a little bit about Alex.
So Alex is just infectiously optimistic and positive. He never allows any negativity to get to him and never allows himself to wade into what is so tempting to wade into, which is like personal territory and getting into back and forth. Because I'll tell you what, you don't think you can be called a racist until it happens to you. I never in my life would have thought that somebody would try to make me out to be a racist given, you know, my, where I grew up and who I'm friends with and what my family complexion looks like. I never would have thought that would have happened. And yet it did because of socialists. And I engaged in back and forth. Josh engaged in back and forth, but Alex never did. And I think that might have been what saved him. And you got to understand that he was going up against people who have been involved in the party for decades. You know, Sam Goldstein, he is a at-large member. He's been an at-large member of the committee multiple times. He was running for vice chair. I mean, and Alex beat him. And it was a narrow victory too. So it's, I don't know that he would have won if it not had been for the Mises presence.
Mm. And the secretary was also up, and I do not believe that she's endorsed by your caucus, but I think she's an ally. Is she an ally?
I would say so. Yeah. She is not officially endorsed. You're talking about Karen Ann Harlos. Mm-hmm. She was a regional representative. Now she's the secretary, and while she wasn't officially endorsed, I would say the Mises caucus is friendly with the Radical caucus, and she has been very highly involved with the Radical caucus for quite some time.
Out of all of this, and it, I think what I'm going to talk about next definitely comes out of what you were talking about earlier about the war that Nick Sarwak, the chair. The reelected chair of the Libertarian Party had with Tom Woods, and I guess Tom and Scott and everybody going down there and spending time with you guys, it came out that I guess somebody had mistakenly said that Nick Sarwak had beaten Tom Woods, or Tom Woods was running for chair, and Nick said something online like, you know, Tom Woods is not, as far as we know, Tom Woods isn't a member of the party. And then all of a sudden, Tom Woods responded to that and said, well, that's changed today. And it seems like ever since that happened, a snowball effect has taken place where Dave Smith, you know, I know he was supposed to be at the conference at the Take Human Action Bash, and at the last minute he had something happen and he couldn't go. He followed suit, as minor as it is. I announced that I would be, rejoining after a 10 year absence, the LP, and that I would be promoting the Mises Caucus. And then it seems like today you had another person jumped in.
Yeah, Jason Stapleton is now a member of the Libertarian Party, and that was one that I was not convinced we would be able to get personally.
Yeah, it seems like, and just from talking to you, how many requests to join the Mises Caucus Facebook group have you had in the last let's call it week, 7 days?
Hundreds at least. Yeah. And dozens and dozens of people at least saying that they are now joining the party, or they are now renewing their membership of the party. And I think it's kind of the party establishment's worst nightmare.
Yeah, it seems from what I've seen online in the groups that people are posting up screenshots of their joining the LP, and not even joining the LP. They're putting in the comment section that they're joining the LP because of the Mises Caucus. I know that you've been, you told me you've been busy as shit the past couple of days. What's going on in your mind?
A lot of things. Basically, I'm just trying to drown out the noise. You know, I'm trying to drown out because there's a lot of really kind words, and I appreciate every one of them, but I can't get caught up in that, because now I feel like, I feel like I'm the steward almost of the people who have joined. You know, they're directly saying, oh, well, the Mises Caucus got me to join, so I can't let these people down, is essentially how I feel, you know? So what I'm working on right now is to, because the Mises Caucus has basically just existed as an idea. I mean, we have a platform, we have a website that you can read the platform at lpmisescaucus.com. But, you know, the platform is essentially what has binded us. We don't really have a official membership and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm working to change that. I want to turn this into the potential is so high, and the signs are so good that I'm going to try to turn this into an actual organization to produce content and to, you know, get candidates elected and kind of get that positive feedback loop going again that I was telling you about earlier, because, you know, if we're talking with each other and we're producing content and we're having fun, that's going to motivate us to do some work. You know, it's going to motivate us to get involved locally, to get a local chapter going, to, you know, put up a ballot initiative to legalize something or something, you know, like get people motivated and working. And once you start working and then you start seeing results, that's much more fun, and it just becomes this positive feedback loop. So that's ultimately what I'm trying to keep my sights on, because I think the potential here, you know, I think there's potential to get really major libertarian voices out there. You know, Larry Sharp is a great libertarian voice. Might not be necessarily the style that us nerdy economists, you know, historian loving people, like, but he's a great libertarian voice. That guy needs to make the debates, you know. We have state level candidates, Brandon Finney, Caleb Dyer, Laura Ebke, who, you know, some of them might not be Austrians per se, but at the same time, if we can show that we can get them reelected at the state level, that is a huge statement. If we can get Murray Sabrin, who's running for Senate out of New Jersey, this guy had Murray Rothbard on his dissertation committee in the 70s. If we can get that guy in the debates, you know, Jeff Scott, another Austrian who's published with the Mises Institute, he's running for Congress down in South Carolina. If we can get him in the debates, and that's what this is ultimately about. It's a vehicle to expand this message, get it out there, and then just like what Ron Paul always said, I don't see winning elections as the primary goal. I see spreading the message and spreading the understanding of this message as the primary goal. And if we win people over to the goodness of our ideas, then they will vote our way, and we could use that as a barometer for how much ass we're actually kicking.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Murray Sabrin. I have a friend of mine who I've known forever who actually works. He's a teacher at Ramapo, where Murray's been forever now, and he's helped produce some of Murray's Federal Reserve documentary on YouTube. And yeah, I mean, anybody who's listening to this, go to YouTube, Murray Sabrin, Federal Reserve, and watch that documentary. That's one of the best documentaries you will ever see on the Federal Reserve. But yeah, Murray reached out to me the other night, and I'm going to have him on the show, because I'm sure by you quoting and talking about his dissertation, having Murray Rothbard on his committee, that he has a chance to win this. The people he's running against are completely corrupted. And one guy, you know, Bob Menendez is looking at charges.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, you know, Murray, this unbelievably gentle but brilliant man, I mean, he actually has a chance. And to be able to get a real libertarian, I mean, an Austrian, into into government, into national government. This is, I think that this is the one chance, I mean, besides Ron Paul, of course, that, that I can look at right off, just glaring at it and saying, oh, he has a shot. And if he does it, if he has a shot, I think everybody else that you've mentioned has a shot. And, you know, I've been talking to numerous people who aren't, you know, who like what the Mises Caucus is doing, but you're not endorsing them. They may be allies, they may be friends, but, like you said, you know, winning would be wonderful, but just getting the message out there, getting 50 or 60 Ron Pauls, you know, people with the Ron Paul message going locally and getting in local debates and having people hear that, it's true, I mean, what I bring it back to is this. I became an ANCAP shortly after the 2008 election. I didn't even pay attention to the 2012 election. That's how out of it I was by that point. And what I've come to realize lately is that if we're going to see this movement grow, it has something like what happened in 2007, 2008, and continued in 2012 has to be put into the spotlight again. And I mean, I see what you guys are promoting. I read your platform. Your platform is as solid as could be. I think you guys are on the right track, and I'm going to do everything I can through this podcast, through social media, to try to help in any way, shape, or form. And anybody who's listening, who's going, oh, he's sold out, he's this, that, and everything, you were not, I will tell you that you were not around in 2007. You weren't around in 2007 to realize that a fucking Republican up on the stage with two simple messages, they hate us because we're over there, and the Fed is the reason why you're there, why you're where you are right now, even if you don't realize it.
Yeah, if you're under 35, that's certainly the case.
Yeah. Because even if you listen to, even if you were brought to this by Dave Smith or Stefan Molyneux or Tom Woods or Bob Murphy, whoever it was, all of these people were inspired by Ron Paul. I mean, some of these guys knew of Ron Paul long ago.
Even media outlets. I mean, Zero Hedge was popularized by and popular in the Ron Paul campaign, audience, we'll say, and Ben Swan got popularized there. The Free Thought Project, which is a really cool news website, got started there. The anti-media started there, which is unfortunately shifted lefter than I would like, but they started there. There's just a lot of seeds that were planted in that campaign soil, and the connections and the camaraderie that comes out of that is so infectious that, I mean, look at me and you. We're talking about 11 years ago. You know, who could tell me what they were like, you know, outside of their career or whatever, what were they doing that they were passionate about 11 years ago, you know, that they haven't had significant gains on, you know, per se, 11 years later, and yet they're still fired up to do it. You know what I mean? Like, you can't, that's something that's not, I don't know how to describe something like that. It's just something deep inside that needs to be lit up.
Well, it really took root back then. And Ron Paul was so, I mean, and Ron Paul, the greatest thing about Ron Paul is he's not the greatest speaker in the world. It was the message. I knew there was something wrong with our foreign policy. I knew it from 2003. I knew it from 2001. I couldn't figure out why we were going into Afghanistan when the hijackers were almost all from Saudi, but I knew there was something wrong, but everything was so rah-rah, and if you questioned it, you were not supporting the troops and all that happy horse shit that was coming out then. And then Ron Paul got up on a stage, and he said it. I mean, he said exactly what I had deep down inside of me, but I couldn't figure out. And he said, they hate us because we're over there. We need to leave these people alone. And I'm like, damn, that's it. And then he started talking about the Federal Reserve. Yeah.
And even more than just the message, you know, the message did what it did. But it, what's interesting to me is that when you hear Ron talk about Mises, it's not necessarily, oh, well, you know, the economics of it. He always talks about Mises' character and Mises' willingness to stand on his principles no matter what and never back down and always be a gentleman while doing it. You know, and then that was something that really attracted me to Ron Paul. You know, like he was very courageous and he was very consistent. And even the people that hated him had to respect him. You know, everybody said, oh, I like mm-hmm. Ron Paul except on foreign policy. But, or, well, you know, he's been saying the same thing for 40 years, you know, like all that kind of stuff. You know, even people that hated him had to respect him. And it was that character that also did something deep for me.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you, because I know you talk about this all the time, and I've heard you talk about it before. Go a little bit into where you see cryptocurrency helping to move this along.
So you mean party-wise or big picture-wise?
Big picture.
Okay, big picture-wise. So unless you were involved, like involved in the crypto community and really an investor, because investors are going to look at all the different coins and use cases and see what they're really all about. You might just, like most people just know about Bitcoin and, you know, Ethereum and that kind of stuff. And, oh, it's a digital money. That's cool. However, so let me break down Nexus for you. What blockchain has the ability to do is any sector of the economy where information is transferred, so pretty much everything, can adopt this. And what that gives these companies the ability to do now is to transact data or even assets to each other in a peer-to-peer fashion that is immutable and secure without any third party. And this can be used in a whole variety of ways. So let's look at Nexus. Nexus, what they're doing is, the founder of Nexus is a guy named Colin Cantrell. Okay, Colin Cantrell's father is a guy named Jim Cantrell. Jim Cantrell is the co-founder of SpaceX, and he is now the CEO of another private space organization called Vector Space Systems. Vector and Nexus are partnered. So Nexus is going to be launching small satellites into low Earth orbit to beam down decentralized internet to the planet to give them access to the internet, well, blockchain, which will require the internet. So what you're talking about is possible there is, let's say you beam down and so there's like a lot of people in Africa that and other really, really poor areas that don't have any access to the internet. They don't have any access to any banking services. So they don't really have the ability to engage in the marketplace that well. And then they might not even have that many resources around if they could. So what you're essentially offering the world is an opportunity to access banking services via cryptocurrency, the blockchain, and internet. And that means that we could see a free market revolution over the course of the next few decades, the likes of which the world has never seen. And that's just one way you can use it. So that's one way in that the technology will break up, say, the internet service provider cartel. You know, and then you have these other coins. I don't know why I'm forgetting the name of it, but that offer decentralized data sharing. So
Zencash.
Well, what Zencash does is they're a platform like Ethereum. So basically, that's a platform for which companies can make their own private blockchains and specialize them for the needs of their company from. And so like Dent. Dent allows you to, Iyunga. Iyunga allows you to use your, it could be your phone, could be your computer, could be your laptop, your tablet, whatever, to broadcast the internet. And as people use your internet broadcast, you will earn Iyunga tokens. And the wider this network gets, the more value a Iyunga token will ultimately be worth. So they incentivize you breaking up the internet service monopoly. And that's the whole thing. That's the big picture there is that it can be used in so many different ways. So like Pat Byrne, I'm really big on Pat Byrne, running for president as a libertarian in 2020. And I actually am going to have a meeting with him in 2 days. But he is creating a project called T0. Okay. T0 is a is a blockchain alternative to the New York Stock Exchange. So you can get on this thing, exchange, I think, securities, cryptos, ICOs, and stocks together. And by having it on a blockchain, what that ultimately means is that every transaction that happens on this exchange is verifiable and reviewable by anybody. So meaning the only way that you can really commit fraud is like hand-to-hand cash transactions. It brings transparency to Wall Street, you know? And he raised, I think, like $100 million in his first 2 weeks in ICO on this thing, and that was only from accredited fat cat investors.
And Pat is the founder of Overstock.com, right?
He's the founder of Overstock.com. He's a PhD in philosophy. He's also the CEO of Medici Ventures, which is a blockchain venture capital outfit. That guy's got a hell of a resume.
Wow. Well, I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to let you wrap it up. Where's the best place to get information about the Libertarian Party Mises Caucus? And, if anybody wants, I know you're busy now, but if anybody wants to contact anyone in the Mises Caucus to ask questions, what's the best way to do that?
Well, you can go to our website, lpmisescaucus.com, read our platform. The community is really where it's at. So you're going to want to follow us on Twitter or follow our page on Facebook, but really the action's in the Facebook group. That's where I spend a lot of my time and, kind of getting a pulse on the community. And if you want to get a hold of us, you could just, you know, send me a friend request or you could send an email to lpmisescaucus@gmail.org or gmail.com. Sorry.
Cool. I know that you're having requests to join the Facebook group, and the Facebook group is private, so you have to get. So, how long can they expect to wait right about now?
Might be a couple of days, because basically we have, but it's for good reason, you know. I mean, we've had issues before where basically trolls were coming in, saying something racist, screenshotting it, and then giving it to a troll friend of theirs to say, oh, look at this terrible stuff that's going on in the media. Like, that's the level of crap that we were dealing with. So our moderator team is doing a good job making sure that nobody is a troll.
You're scaring people, man. You're the reaction that I've seen just from Reason Magazine is the kind of reaction that we saw against Ron Paul when he started saying the things that he did in 2007. And I think that should excite people.
It excites me.
All right, man. I know just from what you've told me, I know you're busy as hell. So I'm going to let you go. I want to thank you for your time. And, like I said, you need anything from me, you know, reach out to me, you know, I'll be in the group. You could hit me up. You hit me up through Messenger, and especially your people that are, you know, the people that you're sponsoring that are going to be endorsed. Let me know so I can get them on here and I can grill them, because I guarantee you I'm not going to let them come. I'm not going to let them come on here, and I'm not going to softball them. If they're getting in a race, they need to be ready for it, and. I want to talk to them, and I want to put them through the ringer a little bit first. Do you have a problem with that?
No, not at all. I'm sure they would be cool with it too.
Yeah, everybody seems to be really cool, and I encourage anybody who wants to get into the Facebook group and everything. You'll start to realize that this isn't, it's not, there's all different kinds of libertarians in there, but I think they all have one goal, and that is to make the Libertarian Party libertarian again.
Absolutely.
Hey, yeah, it's a motto that's been going around, but make the LP libertarian again. So keep up the good work, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me. I'll be in touch.
I want to thank you for tuning in to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Michael for coming on. I want to remind you about my books, Freedom Through Memedom, The Kids Are Not All Right. Check them out on Amazon. Check them out on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. I'll be back at you in a couple days with another podcast. So take care. Have a great week. Bye.